You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2023 on Monocle Radio.
Three great democracies want to be friends with Russia and China for some reason. India decides that its school kids need to be less educated, and Canada wants its citizens to stop smoking. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and the first Monocle staffers eliminated at today's lunchtime croquet tournament were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariella Bevan. They'll discuss the day's big stories, plus we'll meet the director of a new film dramatising the arrest of NSA leaker Reality Winner and find out what the EU is doing in space. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, whose name you would think by now I know how to pronounce. God, I've said too many words this week. Let's just go out and come in again. I'm joined today by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, senior correspondent and music curator and host of The Stack, and Mariella Bevan from the Monocle Radio Desk production team. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
I've set an intimidatingly high bar for coherent broadcasting this evening, haven't I? Try not to let it get to you. I have been away from the Daily all week is my excuse. I have been at the GlobeSec Summit in Bratislava. There will be plenty more of that on the Foreign Desk tomorrow, and indeed a little bit of it later today. But Mariella, much more excitingly than that, you have been to see Beyoncé.
I did. I went on Monday.
Did it? Amazing. Did it live up to all expectations?
It did. Although, I will say, a lot of people around me weren't actually moving, which I was quite disappointed about. I thought people would be, you know, really excited, gassed, you know, but they weren't.
Why were they not moving? Was it because they were too busy taking pictures of themselves looking like they were enjoying it?
That might be part of it. There was a few boyfriends that had been dragged along that definitely didn't want to be there. I could tell.
I've heard that from our other colleague Steph, who also has been to the show, and she was like, there was this tension, you know, the partners, they had to be there just because, and I kind of get it, you know, I'm a fan of Madonna and I take my partner and say, you have to come with me, there's no other choice, but I guess they have to, you know, they have to be a little more animated.
Does your partner do that thing of standing there seething while consoling himself by thinking about which cricket match he's going to drag you along to?
Well, probably. I mean, to be honest, I mean, not cricket, but he prefers Cher. And so he's probably gayer than me in a way. That's the problem.
Well, we will have more from Fernando and Mariella shortly, but we will start the show with one of the few global gatherings to which Russia is still invited. In South Africa, a meeting of the foreign ministers of the BRICS nations, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. As yet unindicted, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was present as the group called for a rebalancing of the global order away from the dominance of the West and in the direction of countries such as those represented by BRICS. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Rebecca Tinsley, former BBC journalist, founder of Network for Africa and regular guest here on The Daily. Rebecca, what point are the BRICS nations trying to make by having their representatives photographed standing cheerfully next to Sergei Lavrov?
Well, they're trying to rebalance, what they call rebalance the global system away from Anglo-Saxon values, as they describe them. What they're saying, you know, if they were sincere about rebalancing the economic concentration, then they would have a legitimate case. But let's be honest, these nations are flirting, and many which are flirting with this non-aligned group. They're ruled by a tiny, unaccountable elite who are keener on making sure they have immunity from prosecution and abolishing term limits and rubbishing the idea of the universality of human rights than they are in actually rebalancing the economic system. And there is a huge measure of hypocrisy here as well, because you have to look at most of these countries, their populations still yearn to move to the countries that they hold in such contempt. In other words, Europe, North America and Australia.
Well, indeed so. And when you look at the five nations which comprise BRICS, three of them are very much not like two of the others, which is to say that India, Brazil and South Africa, flawed democracies, though they all doubtless are nevertheless democracies. Why do they see Russia and China as a team they want to be on?
I think that this is basically an anti-American gesture on their part, and they don't want to be involved in the mess in Ukraine. But I think it's important to mention that to some extent, we in the West have brought this on ourselves by our ahistorical attitudes and our sort of willful amnesia about our track record of lecturing these countries on democracy and human rights, while at the same time we've cozied up to some fairly unsavory regimes. And I think they're probably sick of hearing us lecture them on democracy and human rights when so often we really have a dodgy track record ourselves.
I mean, do you get any sense, though, that any of those countries which do have a dodgy track record, you're quite right, and which are open to accusations of hypocrisy for lecturing the likes of, well, South Africa and Brazil and India in particular about what they should and should not be doing, has anybody in the last 16 months come up with some better ideas for winning them round to the West's way of thinking?
No, and that is a problem, because really ever since Donald Trump made it really clear that America was disengaging, there's been a bit of a vacuum. And Russia and China, of course, have rushed into this vacuum. The sadness is that anybody in the non-aligned world actually believes that Russia or China gives a damn about the great oppressed, when actually really they're little more than neo-colonialists themselves, keen to exploit the developing world.
Rebecca Tinsley, thank you for joining us. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, we have you here and we're going to hold you answerable for the entire Brazilian nation. But there is a serious question here, which we have talked about before, in that it is weird that the only common point between the previous president, Jair Bolsonaro, and the current president, Lula da Silva, should be that they're both weirdly fond of Vladimir Putin. Is there not going to be any uproar in Brazil at all at the spectacle of Brazil's foreign minister being photographed standing next to Sergei Lavrov?
Listen, it is a weird situation, but of course I wouldn't call fondness for Vladimir Putin, but it is complicated. And you know what Rebecca was saying about the track record of Western countries. This is discussed a lot in the press in Brazil, and I'm sure it would be discussed in South Africa, in India perhaps. And you know, but for me, particularly in Brazil always wanted to be the country that brings peace to the world. Sometimes it used to work in the past. We used to bring a new vision, but I have a feeling that with this conflict in Ukraine, it's not really working out. Zelensky gave an interview to the Latin American press just a few days ago, and he said, I think in a very ironic way, he said, Lula is trying to be original with his peace plan. But he said in the interview as well that he really wants to meet Lula. Remember, they didn't meet, I believe, in the G7 because I think there were some problems with the scheduling. But he still wants to meet Lula. He knows that Latin America is important. I do understand Brazil's position. You know, I do think the West can be quite hypocrite at times. But in this instance of Ukraine, I have a feeling that Brazil is losing out to not align itself with Europe and the US.
Well, let's stick with the subject of India, which appears to be taking a somewhat counterintuitive approach to encouraging further growth of the knowledge-based industries which have powered its recent economic progress. For reasons surpassing understanding, the next generation of Indian school kids are to be steered clear of such topics as evolution, the periodic table of elements, electricity and magnetism. Beyond that, anything related to pollution or resource management has also been snipped from textbooks, which is, of course, perfectly understandable, as India, of all places, has no issues at all with either of those things. Mariella, do we have the least idea what is going on here or why it is going on?
Well, it seems to have started because of COVID. They wanted to reduce pressures on students, which I think I can understand in India because, you know, there obviously are probably better ways of doing things, depending on what your opinion is. But in India, there probably aren't many other ways of, you know, that they had to, there were pressures to go remote and they might not have had as much internet access. And, you know, the pressure to do that would have been quite difficult on when there is not the infrastructure there. So that is, it is one way of relieving the pressure. But I think it's now 2 years on and they're still continuing to remove these subjects from the curriculum. So I think that's why there's been such an uproar.
Is there a pattern emerging here, Fernando, of populist governments being just afraid of science for some reason?
Yes, and you know, I've read about Modi's autocratic tendencies, but this is ridiculous, especially coming from India. Of course, it's the image they portray, but I think it's true. I mean, when I think of India, I do think of innovation in science.
It's absolutely true.
Exactly, in science and technology. And to do that, that's going to be terrible for India's image to the world. That's actually a way that India differentiates itself even from China. They have this. So it's really hard to understand why they're doing that. It's very much flawed. But it's interesting. I actually didn't know what Mariella was saying, that, you know, they want to relieve the children. But still, I think they can do that with other ways, but not removing the teaching of evolution of the periodic table, for God's sake. It's ridiculous.
Well, indeed so. We did want to try and broaden this conversation out into something perhaps a little bit more constructive and to ask you both what we would put into curriculums rather than take out of them. Mariella, because I'm going to go ahead and guess that you left school rather more recently than anybody else at this table, I'm going to go ahead and ask you first, are there things that you think now were glaring omissions in the curriculum when you were coming through?
Yes, definitely. I think the first two things that came to mind were both comprehensive sex education and financial literacy, because I left school, especially financial literacy, I didn't know anything really about how to manage my own finances. And that's something that is, you know, economic policy is one of the biggest areas that affects our daily life, and not understanding what is going on in financial policy and in our lives every day, I think, is obviously a big oversight. And then in terms of comprehensive sex education, there is clear evidence that it can help prevent and reduce intimate partner violence and child abuse, as well as encouraging the development of healthy relationships with the self and others. And even the UN's global guidance indicates that we should be starting at the age of 5, obviously with things like talking about the elements of consent. But yeah, I think it should start a lot earlier and be a lot more comprehensive and longer lasting than it is now.
I mean, I don't disagree about either of those things, but is the thing with the comprehensive sex education likely to be the fact that certainly every elected government in the world would be scared absolutely witless of getting hold of that, because you can imagine what a circus that will descend into as soon as any politician tries to suggest anything whatsoever?
Yeah, I think especially when you hear that it's suggested at the age of 5, I think people would freak out because it's got sex in the name. So I think, for example, I think in India they were calling it wellness education instead of sex education, so that they didn't create this, you know, situation among the parents where they were getting really upset about introducing it to their children.
The financial literacy thing, though, Fernando, that still boggles my mind as well, that this stuff isn't taught, at the very least, from the early stages of high school, because you can agree or disagree, I guess, that various things you learn in high school may or may not turn out to be useful, but there's not going to be anybody for whom that is not going to be important.
I mean, I agree. I was going to say also financial literacy. I mean, how to deal with taxes. I mean... we don't know. I mean, when you're going to buy a house, how does mortgage works? And, you know, I'm an adult man here and I still have a lot of questions in my head. But another thing that I was going to say, I want more practical stuff. So I don't know how to sew a t-shirt if there's a hole in it. And that's a shame. I wish school had taught me that and other kind of basic skills of survival. I mean, I can't do anything, basically.
I mean, Mariella, a counter-argument, which I'm just making up in my head right now and therefore may not have thought all the way through, might be that governments, departments of education, schools might take the view that this sort of stuff is very much what parents should be teaching their children.
Yeah, I mean, parents don't really have as much time as, you know, parents aren't taught how to teach these things. They might know more about it, but they might not necessarily know the best way to put that across to their children. And I think, you know, some people talk about the talk, but that might not necessarily go as well as they hope.
Fernando, what else would you like to see added to the curriculum?
Well, of course, but that's just for the fun of it. I think more pop culture classes as well. And you know what? In this age where everything's so divided, I do think schools should try it. I should say, you know what? You're entitled to have an opinion. You can still be friends, because it is true. I mean, literally every single country in the world is getting divided. I wonder if schools can try to say, you know what, you can hold that view and that's fine. You know, we can still be friends. I don't know how this class would be called, but, you know, you get the point.
Mariella, just finally on this, as the representative at this table of people who have been to school rather more recently, did you get the sense that there is a certain timidity from school teachers, from schools, of teaching anything that might result in uproar once child X goes home and tells their parents what they learned at school today?
I definitely think there is that concern. I mean, thinking back to the way we act in the classroom as teenagers, I know my mum was saying that she'd love to be a fly on the wall in those situations, and, you know, poor them, really, because it's difficult being a teacher, and they're obviously going to be held accountable by the parents. But ultimately, I think it's up to the governments to make sure that it's part of law and not up to teachers and schools to be implementing these policies.
And parents are more arrogant these days, I feel. Sorry, that's quite a broad statement. But I have a feeling, I think in the past, people used to respect more the teacher. But now parents, they're so one-sided, and they always defend the kid and never listen to the teacher. Again, I'm not looking at numbers. This is what I'm feeling more recently. And that's quite interesting. That's why schools is so important as well.
Well, to Canada on the subject of public education, which has found another means to further discourage the already widely discouraged habit of smoking, as still practiced by some 13% of Canadians who have somehow perceived an upside into entering into a higher purchase agreement to buy cancer. Tobacco-related disease kills some 48,000 Canadians annually. Canada is to go beyond emblazoning health warnings on packets of cigarettes and instead apply them to individual cigarettes. The tips will be adorned with presumably very small reminders of the dangers of tobacco consumption. Fernando, is this going to make a difference? I'm not necessarily against repeated, relentless, pervasive public health warnings about the dangers of tobacco, but is anybody at this point, certainly in a country like Canada, unaware of the dangers?
I don't think it will make a difference, to be honest. And actually, one concern I might have, it does look pretty cool. I mean, the design is great, actually. It might actually make people smoke more. I mean, I think this is a little bit of an exaggeration as well. Like, it's very difficult for me because I do tend to glamorize cigarettes. I'm very silly in that sense. But I do believe that, you know, we should make sure that people know about the, you know, cigarettes, they're terrible for you. They can cause cancer. They might kill you. I agree with you. But in every single cigarette, is this really necessary? I mean, I don't think it's going to make a single difference, not even 0.1%.
Mariella, what do you think? I mean, because I guess there are health warnings to an extent on, you know, individual receptacles of alcohol, maybe, or at least an announcement of the alcoholic content. But I mean, does that stop anybody from buying it who was going to buy it?
No, I don't think so. And also, I think big part of it is also the kind of the cultural view of it. I think in some countries, it is very normal to smoke. In Italy, for example, in the cities, they have tobacco vending machines where you can get tobacco 24 hours, and it's quite normal for people to smoke at a young age. Whereas in other countries, I think it is a lot more frowned upon to smoke. So I think that is part of it. It's not, maybe as Fernando says, seen as cool in other places. So I think that makes a huge difference. And I also think the text itself, will people really read that?
Is there an argument, Fernando, that a more effective deterrent is what we have seen in a lot of countries over the last few decades, of just making it more and more difficult to smoke, as in dramatically reducing the number of public spaces where it is permissible?
Well, yes, I think that's the probably more effective way than just labeling out cigarettes. But, you know, I have this issue here as well, that, I think we've done the most we can for to make people stop smoking. I don't think we can go further. I mean, although
we could just ban it completely.
We could ban it, but that's quite controversial because that would just go to the black market and perhaps make every single user a criminal.
Some people doubtless would, but do you think most smokers would find themselves reduced to buying it from dodgy people hiding behind skips?
I think quite a lot of them would, but and also, in my opinion, I think, you know, I think especially young people these days, they don't think cigarettes cool anymore. I'm older, you know, I'm silly. I had a glamorous grandma who used to smoke and I used to look at her and say, oh my God, you're so glamorous. But she's having actually some health issues because of cigarettes. So it's quite a conflicting view. I do think we should just trust the young people today because I think they're smoking less, in fact, than in the past as
but
well.
But they are arguably vaping more, which has become another worry. Mariella, Australia has or is going to ban recreational vaping outright. It would still, as I understand it, be available on prescription as part of a program of getting off tobacco. But there is a thing I have noticed myself in that vaping is usually in public spaces, certainly in this country, subject to the same restrictions as cigarette smoking, but it is next to impossible to police because you smoke a cigarette, you've made a commitment for the next few minutes, whereas people can vape once and stick it back into their pockets. And I see it frequently on buses, trains, in pubs, restaurants, etc., etc.
Yeah, I've seen it in music venues as well. Like people, any indoor space, I think if people can get away with it. I know people who don't even exhale, they just kind of swallow the smoke. So I think, you know, and it doesn't smell either, like cigarettes. It's kind of, it's not as an abhorrent smell. It actually smells quite nice sometimes. So I think it's going to be difficult, and I think it's going to be subject to similar consequences if they ban it completely. I think they'll still be made. People will still be able to vape. I also question whether or not having vapes as a prescription is going to work. I think at the moment people think that if you vaped, that can help you stop smoking, but I think there isn't enough research yet to know whether that's actually true.
My counterpoint to that, and I will admit my interest in this as somebody who has never smoked nor vaped and basically thinks people who do should have, and certainly in public, should have fire hoses turned on them, is that if we knew then, or at least I hope, if we knew then what we know now about cigarette smoking, it would have been sat on and sat on hard right from the off. Are we not still at the point at which we could do that with vaping, just decide, okay, this is a bad idea, it's not happening?
I think it is. We're maybe teetering on the edge, I don't know. I think it is quite a new recreational activity, but there are communities around vaping now. There are these vape shops, you know, where people go and buy bigger and bigger vapes and, you know, different flavors, and people, you know, it's become almost another culture, and I think maybe we're coming to the point where we're a bit late.
And I don't want to sound like a cranky man here as well.
Go on, Fernando. It's Friday,
it's
Fernando.
Friday.
Go nuts. Sound like a cranky man.
I am concerned. I actually never smoked in my life or vaped, and I think the smell of vape, I actually think, is awful as well. The cherry flavor that I see in the streets is horrendous.
It's horrible.
But, I mean, where next? I mean, maybe if sugar is going to be the enemy, I will be defending sugar until the end. So I don't want vape to be banned, but for example, for teenagers, we should be very strict because that's how it started. I don't mind. We can go all the way, but let an adult vape if he or she wants, you know, perhaps not in a busy Oxford street.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariella Bevan, thank you both very much for joining us. You are listening to The Daily on Monocle Radio. Reality Winner was just 26 years old when she was arrested for leaking a secret government document to the media concerning possible Russian interference in the 2016 US presidential election. She had access to the document through her job as a US intelligence officer and translator. A new film stars Sydney Sweeney and tells the story of the FBI agents arriving at Reality Winner's home. The film, which began life as a play, uses the real transcript of this event as the script. Monocle's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs caught up with the film's director, Tina Satter, to find out more.
Hey.
How are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. How's your day today?
It's pretty good. Just got some groceries.
All right. Let's show you who we are.
Tina, thanks so much for coming in to speak to me today about your new film, Reality. For those who don't know who Reality Winner is, who is the central protagonist of your film?
Reality Winner is a real person who in 2017 was a 25-year-old young American woman. She was a former Air Force vet at that point, and she was working for the NSA. And in May 2017, she accessed a top secret document that showed the Russians had tried to hack into election systems in Florida, in the state of Florida, which was being denied in the press at that time. And she printed it out and mailed it to a news outlet. And then several weeks later, was surprised at her home by the FBI and then ultimately arrested and charged under the Espionage Act.
Your film follows Reality, played by Sydney Sweeney, as she gets home and encounters FBI agents. And we kind of slowly learn about why they're there and what she has done. Your film is very unique in the fact that you use the exact transcript, and it started off as a play and now it's been turned into a film. And I wondered, were you kind of interested in the idea and the story of Reality, or did you come across the transcripts first? And was that the basis? Kind of what came first? Was it the story, or was it the actual kind of physical script, I guess?
It was stumbling upon that transcript. It was incredible. And I had, like, right before I came upon the transcript, in the same half hour, I had read a little bit more about Reality online and just free reading. But I was like, oh, wow. It was like 6 months after that she had first been in the news in June. So this was like December 2017. And there was a longer form article. And I was like, wait, that woman with that name, Reality Winner, I hadn't even known what she'd done. The details of her biography were really interesting. And then there was a link to click to this transcript. And the transcript just really felt like I was scrolling through it. Like, I was like, this is like a thriller. When do they get her to admit? And why are they talking about cats? And what is going on? And it was just so stunning to me that we had this window into this, like, on a sunny afternoon in Texas, we were in this room with this girl. I really felt something really, really, like, that artistic tingle when I came upon that transcript.
Yeah, I can imagine. It is incredible. Could you talk a little bit more about what it was like working with the transcript? For example, there are points that are redacted. How did you kind of come up with ways to work around those? And were you ever tempted to add anything into the transcript or take anything out? Were there any kind of problems like that?
I mean, pretty early on in the process, I was pretty sure part of the rigor of this is not manipulating the transcript in any way to serve story. You know what I mean? Like, let's try to, like, really stick to that idea so that some of the integrity of this was what was actually said that day. So once that became sort of a rule, it was quite easy to stick to that of not, you know, taking words out of any lines of dialogue to serve anything. And part of that was that there's these redactions in the transcript. You know, you come to the black bars that, you know, disappear certain things. And so I really wanted to rhythmically keep that in the film. And it seemed exciting to sort of play with what that could be filmically. Like, if a redaction on a page is a black bar, what does it mean to disappear and do that sort of unseen hand of power in the movie that's meaning, like, something can't be heard, something can't be read. So it became a really kind of cool part of, once we were in the edit, of deciding how to deal with those redaction moments.
You've had some communication with Reality and she consulted on this film. Could you tell me more about that relationship and how it's worked?
Well, so while working on the play, I did not speak directly to Reality because she was in a range of prisons through that whole time. And it was extremely hard to be in touch with her. But I was in touch with her mom and sister throughout that, who were like a conduit to Reality, and like, so that she understood the play was happening and had given it her support. But she was released from prison in June 2021, at which point I was like ramping up work on the movie. And so then amazingly got to talk to her directly and Zoom with her and like text her questions. And she just provided really great details essentially of the movie, because turning to the movie, I got to really show what her house was like. I mean, the crazy vulnerability of this is that these FBI agents are questioning her in her own house. They are in her bedroom. I mean, it's just really specific. And so, you know, I had seen some pictures of that, but Reality could talk to us more about what that house looked like, what the agents were wearing. She told us they were wearing these brightly colored golf shorts. She just had really good details. And that was a lot of what I was able to glean. And then her and Sydney Sweeney had their own conversations, just whatever Sydney, you know, reality had been really open to talk to Sid. And so they developed their own relationship to help Sydney.
As well as giving the transcripts, also reality's name, it just seems so perfect for this project. It's obviously the title as well, and it has that double meaning. Could you talk a little bit more about that, I guess?
I write the poetics of her name, Reality Winner. It's just so incredible. I mean, it's one, kind of the first step of how this feels like something sort of more quivering than just real life. And yeah, I mean, and she said herself with the name like Reality, you know, she always has gone through life with a little bit of an edge because you're constantly explaining your name and because it has this meaning for all of us. So that, yeah, because we were going to like show this record of the transcript, which of course is a version of reality, but then like film it and reinterpret and re-inhabit it, we're playing with so many levels of reality. And then even there's this great meta thing of like what happened to her in real life, actually, like those agents are performing something that day in that room, pretending what they don't know. And she, for a long time, performs something back to them.
Reality. We obviously know a lot more than what we're telling you at this point. And I think you know a lot more than what you're telling us at this point. I don't want you to go down the wrong road. I think you need to stop and think about what you're saying and what you're doing. I think it's an opportunity to maybe tell the truth, because telling a lie to an FBI agent is not going to be the right thing. Okay?
So there's just so much reality swirling around this content, and then to merge like our reinterpretation with Sydney, with, you know, we layer in some real images of the real reality to sort of knit in those edges of realness. It felt like a really rich palette of this like hybrid thing of our interpretation of this real document mixed with some real shards of reality herself in it.
That was Tina Satter in conversation with Monocle's Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. The film Reality is out today. And finally on today's Daily, tomorrow's edition of The Foreign Desk is the first of a few episodes we recorded at this week's GlobeSec Forum in Bratislava. We also recorded a whole bunch of other stuff, among which is this interview with Rodrigo da Costa, Executive Director of the European Union Agency for the Space Programme. I began by asking Rodrigo about the agency's mission.
The EU Agency for the Space Programme is an agency of the European Union, so we belong to the European Union, and we are working dedicated to the EU Space Programme. The EU has many activities in space since a very long time, actually. Started with both the navigation activities with Galileo and EGNOS more than 20 years ago. Also, Earth observation, Copernicus, is quite well known. It will have its 25th anniversary in a week or so. And these were the initial activities of the Union in space. Then with time, other activities came along, secured governmental communication, space situational awareness, innovation, research. So a number of things that make the EU space program. We as an agency, we are of course not doing the space program all alone. We are working in partnership. We work with the Commission, we work with the European Space Agency, industry, academia, and we basically have three key roles or three key pillars of activities. We exploit, we secure, we foster the utilization. We exploit means basically we operate, we provide the services of Galileo and EGNOS, so we operate those systems 24/7, making sure that the navigation signals arrive to the users with required accuracy, with the necessary availability. We maintain the systems, we evolve them. We are developing as well GovSatcom as we speak, and we will become the front desk for space surveillance and tracking, which is a key element on space situational awareness globally. We secure means that we are working in the security domain with two main focus. We look at security of the space assets, so making sure that the satellites, the ground systems, they are secure, they are physically secure, and they are cyber secure. But we are also working with the EU governments to provide space data and space services for security-related missions. Mm. Those may be civil security, maybe military security. So how can space data, space services be used every day by EU governments, governmental agencies, authorized users? The last pillar I've mentioned is to foster the utilization. This basically means to help what we call the downstream sector, so those people that are developing applications and tools that use data, that use services from space, from Galileo, from Copernicus, soon from GovSatCom and from IRIS², to tackle concrete market needs. We have our financing mechanisms helping industry, large companies, small companies. We do quite a lot also with entrepreneurs and innovators, startups, to bring space to everyday life.
Is there a particular focus, though, that has come into light as a result of the conflict in Ukraine? You mentioned the defensive military aspects of it. Has what has happened in Ukraine over the last 16 months caused your agency to rethink anything?
Certainly the security domain is an area that is gaining more and more attention, even at political decider level in the European Union. Clearly, it of course started even before the unjustified Russian invasion of Ukraine, but of course it strengthened in the last month, in the last year and a half. It started a year ago or so. The Union published a very important document, which is called the Strategic Compass, which is setting ideas and trends and possibilities for EU involvement in the overall security domain. And recently, the European Commission, together with the External Action Service, published a very important document, which is called the EU Space Strategy for Security and Defense, that is actually putting in place some policy elements, some strategic elements of how space can contribute to the security missions, to security and defense field. And in there, yes, there are a number of activities or potential activities at this point in time that are defined for our agency. Quite broad things, quite diverse things you will find in that document. For example, the creation of an ISAC, an Information Sharing and Analysis Center, dedicated to space for the key actors to share knowledge about cybersecurity, cyber threats, etc. So this is something we are starting to shape right now. Other things like the expansion of our Space Academy. We have a Space Academy so far very much dedicated to entrepreneurship and innovation, to create a second leg dedicated to the security domain in order to increase the knowledge base, to make the actors, institutional actors, private actors more aware of everything that comes with security. So certainly this is an area of focus, and this is an area of growth in the Union.
In that and other realms, do you see yourself as necessarily in competition with private space operations? Or do you think that there are things that privateers can actually do better than the public sector in space?
We are certainly not in competition with the private sector. We work with the private sector. We are there to, together, of course, with the Commission and the Union at large, to put down what are the public needs from the systems, what are the public services that we would like to get. But certainly there is a lot of room and a lot of space for the private initiative and for the private sector. All our implementation of our programs, we do it with private companies. I mean, companies all across the European Union are working in all the dimensions of the space program, be it to build the satellites and the ground systems, to operate them, or then to use the data and services and bring them to market. So the private sector is extremely important in all of this.
Question as well, this is an extremely nerdish but enthusiastic question about space exploration. Is there any part of the EU Agency for the Space Programme's ambitions that involves crewed missions?
No, I have to be very clear in terms of our focus on space is coming from actually the mandate of the European Union and the mandate that the European Parliament, the European Council gave the Commission, and then of course the Commission gave to us, which is to focus on the content of the EU space program. It does not include the research part. It does not include the human space, the manned space or human space flight part. It does not include exploration, but includes many other areas of space that are very relevant for everyday navigation, Earth observation, telecom, innovation, etc.
That was Rodrigo da Costa, Executive Director of the European Union Agency for the Space Programme. And that's all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Mariella Bevan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, also to Rebecca Tinsley at the top of the show. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Monica Lillis. Our sound engineer was Sarah Nicol. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.